This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
This summer, hundreds of billions of tons of ice melted off Greenland. The runoff from July alone measurably raised sea levels around the world. Super scientist Kevin Trenberth from the U.S. National Center for Atmospheric Research talks about hotter oceans, stronger hurricanes like Dorian, and forces melting Greenland ice 2 to 3 times faster than scientists thought possible even 15 years ago. Explaining our dangerous future, Kevin makes a surprising announcement about his own. This famous scientist is leaving Trump's America as the United States of denial guts climate protection regulations. From the UK, climate professor Edward Hanna explains the forces behind the disastrous melting on Greenland. As I come on the air, tropical forests are on fire from the Amazon to the Congo. The Arctic is burning from Alaska to Siberia. That is for next week's show. We take one horrifying disaster at a time here on Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Welcome back. After our first guest, I will do a quick catch-up on a few of the climate lowlights from this summer, including the amazing European July heat wave. Plus, here are two quick questions for you. What country is the world's biggest exporter of natural gas? And then what country is the world's biggest exporter of coal? Answers later in this program.
Radio EcoShock.
Is the astounding melt on Greenland this summer due to natural atmospheric cycles rather than global warming? Dr. Kevin E. Trenberth specializes in the transport of heat, water, and energy in the atmosphere and ocean. He was a pioneer in the study of El Niño and La Niña events and a lead author for 3 reports by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or the IPCC. Originally from New Zealand, Dr. Trenberth is a distinguished senior scientist in the Climate Analysis Section at the National Center for Atmospheric Research, or NCAR, located in Boulder, Colorado. It is an honor to welcome Kevin Trenberth back to Radio EcoShock. In July, a bizarre heat wave poured out of North Africa, setting record-smashing temperatures in many European countries. And then abnormal heat appeared over Greenland. Kevin, were those the same or different heat waves?
I don't know, actually. And that's not a question I'm sure I have a good answer for. The other part of that, the answer, is, of course, that it wasn't just these two. There were major heat waves in the United States before that.
So the whole northern hemisphere really was, or quite a bit of it, was experiencing higher than normal heat, let's say that.
Well, it was a little bit sequential, though. I think the weather situation that was responsible for the heat waves in the central and eastern parts of the U.S. was part of the weather system which helped pick up the air from the Sahara and northern Africa and brought it into Europe. And so in that sense, the heat waves may be a little bit related. But that, of course, doesn't really carry through to Alaska. The Alaskan heat wave is very likely a different animal.
Now, a group of scientists led by the Belgian researcher Javier Fetwis suggests that the massive meltwater release from Greenland in 2019 was mainly driven by a natural atmospheric cycle called the North Atlantic Oscillation, or NAO. And I'm wondering, this sort of counters the obvious that the Arctic is wildly warmer this century. Surely that is causing Greenland to melt. Kevin, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, it's really always a combination of both, isn't it? So nowadays, there is nothing completely natural. But one way of thinking about it is that the day-to-day weather is largely natural variability. But it's set in an environment which has changed. And it has changed in the memory of the climate change is through the oceans. And so the oceans are systematically warmer than they used to be, and the air above the oceans is warmer and moister than it used to be. Now, in addition, of course, at high latitudes, there is quite a bit less ice. There's less sea ice. There's already less glacial ice on land in various places. And so that's the different environment that the weather is now occurring in. So when you have a heat wave, it's largely caused immediately by the anticyclone, the very high pressure that occurs, and often with the winds from in the northern hemisphere out of the south. So they're warm winds and very settled weather. And that's when we get the highest temperatures. And so it's partly a weather phenomenon always. The North Atlantic Oscillation certainly helps to play a role in setting up patterns in Greenland and Europe. It's most active in the wintertime, but in the wintertime, when it's very warm in Europe, it's very cold in Greenland. And when it's very warm in Greenland, it's very cold in Europe. That's the way the weather situation sits up. And in the summertime, the North Atlantic Oscillation is usually not as strong. So I'm more inclined to think that, yes, the weather and the natural variability is playing a role in helping to determine when the heat wave occurs and where it occurs. But the setting for it, the environment for it, is very much related to the overall warming of the planet, the so-called global warming.
The concept of North Atlantic Oscillation, it's not widely known to the public, and struggling to grasp it, we're offered the analogy of the better-known El Niño-La Niña cycle, also called ENSO, and you were a pioneer on the impacts of ENSO. Is that a good way to understand the NAO?
Well, it's still a somewhat different animal. ENSO, El Niño, involves very much the interactions between the atmosphere and the ocean. And as a result, it has quite a substantial memory. And so the evolution of an El Niño event takes at least a year. And, you know, El Niños occur about every 3 to 5 or maybe 3 to 7 years, something like that. And that relates very much to the interactions with the ocean. The North Atlantic Oscillation, on the other hand, is just an atmospheric phenomenon. It's not involved in the ocean. It doesn't have the same memory that the El Niño phenomenon has. And so it often can set up a pattern that can persist for a few months. And so it's a longer time scale than normal weather, but it's not quite the same as El Niño in that regard. But it is very much a preferred pattern. We can simulate it very well in our models, and it occurs largely because of the, you know, the disposition of where the land is, and especially where Greenland is, because of the way in which it blocks the otherwise westerly flow that might prefer to occur in that region.
It worries me. It seems like a little dangerous to suggest that Greenland will right itself towards cooling in a new cycle of the NAO instead of just melting during this and the following centuries as the world surpasses 2 or 3 degrees of warming. Is that a worry?
Well, yes, Greenland, of course, once you start melting ice, a lot of that becomes irreversible. You can't just put it back. I mean, we do have an annual cycle where it snows in the wintertime, and we do put some ice back. But, you know, big melting of ice like has been happening in Greenland, you know, that's largely gone now, I think. And so this is a part of the process whereby, you know, Greenland is on a track to melting under the current environmental conditions that exist, especially with the increased carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Well, let me go back just a little bit, because if you go back, say, 15 years or something like that, we tended to treat Greenland like a great big ice block. And it was estimated that if you wanted to melt it and you had quite warm conditions, like the kind of conditions we might expect to occur, it would take 2,000 or 3,000 years to melt Greenland. But the best estimates now are that it would actually take less than 1,000 years. But it's still quite a long time. And the difference is because now we are taking into account all of the complex crevasses and fractures and water that runs across the surface of Greenland. And it's not a big ice block at all. It's actually quite dynamic. And there are glaciers within the Greenland ice cap itself that flow to the ocean. And, you know, exactly where they go, it does depend a little bit on the weather, and how active they are certainly depends a bit on the weather. But it's melting.
Could an emerging new climate regime change the North Atlantic Oscillation itself? What do you think?
Well, that's possible because it does relate to the latitude of the overall westerlies. And the North Atlantic Oscillation is really a weakening or a strengthening of the overall westerlies across the North Atlantic. And in the positive phase, the westerlies are active further north. The storm track is further north. It's very warm in Europe. And the whole, all of the storms that go all the way from Europe into Siberia tend to have a particular track. And in the negative phase, the whole pattern tends to shift further south, and it's a lot weaker in the north, and you get very cold conditions in that case in Europe. And so as climate change develops, the overall pattern, I suppose one way to think about it is that it might become a little more summer-like. And in summertime, the North Atlantic Oscillation is simply not as active as it is in winter.
We saw a similar level of Greenland ice loss, I'm told, in 2012, although it happened much faster. Is it possible we're entering a period where supermelts become more common, returning faster as climate change develops?
Yeah, so 2012 is the year of the lowest Arctic sea ice amount at the moment. And it was set up by a very large persistent anticyclone that developed over part of the Arctic region. There was a lot of sunshine at just the right time. And in the Arctic, as soon as you start to get sunshine and some ice melts, then there's less reflection back to space. And so there's a feedback process that can amplify conditions. This year, I think they are very likely challenging to see whether or not the Arctic sea ice might be at record low levels and maybe beat out 2012. We'll have to see just how that turns out. And, there's a weather aspect to that. So 2012 holds the record at the moment, but we certainly expect to see more of those kind of things.
Well, regarding sea ice loss, we also have new science published in Nature Climate Change from Russell Blackport's team, and it counters observations by Jennifer Francis and others that Arctic sea ice loss may be related to changes in the jet stream and colder winters in parts of North America. Where do you come in regarding that discussion?
The work from Jennifer Francis and so on has argued that the changes in the sea ice loss and the other changes in the Arctic are causing the changes in the jet stream and the changes in the weather farther south. And I certainly think that's a very questionable argument. But going in the other direction, I don't think there's any doubt whatsoever. The changes in the jet stream and even changes in when we have an El Nino event, we get surges of warm air up into Alaska. And the whole pattern of the weather can change. And that's one of the big factors in amplifying the ice loss from one year to the next. That's partly why it fluctuates. But the question is, what about going in the other direction? If there's a loss of sea ice, how does that affect the weather systems? How does that affect the jet stream? The difficulty is that in the summertime or the late summer, that's when the sea ice loss is the biggest, whereas the wintertime, there's no sunshine. And so if there's less sea ice, the sun feedback effect can't come into play. And so it would have to be the oceans directly. And you can do the sums, and it just simply doesn't add up in my view.
And your research into the ways atmospheric heat is stored in the ocean is highly cited. Is the transfer of human-induced heat continuing into the ocean in an orderly way, or is that changing as a sink?
Well, it's on a global basis, it's pretty regular. In fact, that's the best single indicator that the planet is warming. The 2018 is the warmest year for the global oceans. 2017 is the second warmest. Now, it turns out 2015 is the third warmest and 2016 is the fourth warmest. The reason 2016 is a little bit less than 2015 is actually because there was a big El Nino event then, and some heat during an El Nino event, some heat comes out of the ocean back into the atmosphere, and that's why we tend to have the warmest global mean surface temperatures in 2016. So 2016 is the warmest year for the surface temperatures, but for the oceans, 2018 stands out. Now, where the warmest patch in the ocean occurs certainly moves around from one year to the next. So in 2017, one of the warmest patches was in the Gulf, and that led to Harvey and all of the hurricane activity, Maria and Irma, in that region. That was a big factor. But in 2018, one of the warmest patches was off of the coast of the Carolinas. And so, other places in the Indian Ocean this past year, there were two very unusual, they call them cyclones, but it's effectively a hurricane that went into the Mozambique area and caused tremendous flooding and unusual damage in Africa. And then there was another one called Fani that went up into India and Pakistan that also caused quite a lot of damage. And so those were quite unusual in that regard. So where the hot spots occur from one year to the next can certainly vary, and that's partly because of things like El Nino and maybe the North Atlantic Oscillation or the weather more generally. Where the hottest spot occurs certainly can vary. But as a whole, the oceans are warming up. There's no doubt whatsoever.
It seems to me a lot of the newest science coming about Antarctica melting also cites a hotter ocean affecting the ice melt there.
Well, Antarctica and in the southern oceans are a very interesting case. Our analysis suggests that some of the biggest warming is actually occurring in the southern oceans. But the difference is that there are very strong winds there, and a lot of that heat gets carried down to greater depths in the ocean. And so how much of it is manifested at the surface where it can affect the sea ice and the sea ice distribution, that is one of the things that can vary a bit from year to year. And there was a period of time where the nature of the winds was leading to an increase in Antarctic sea ice. That can happen if the winds happen to be coming or blowing off of the continent more, and they carry the sea ice out further. So the sea ice extent is not necessarily a very good indicator because it may be quite thin. But in the last few years, we've seen some remarkably low Antarctic sea ice amounts, and the Antarctic region seems to be catching up a little bit with what's going on in the Arctic.
Kevin Trenberth, why are you moving back to New Zealand?
Partly because I have family there. My daughter has moved there, and my grandkids are there, and I'm close to retiring. And so that's a big incentive. But I have to say that I'm quite upset with the Trump administration and the Republicans and their approach to this whole problem. It has affected my funding and the ability to do research. And I think they're jeopardizing the futures of the next generations and the planet Earth. And it's been a very, very disappointing response. And it's one thing to have a president who is off the rails, but it's another thing to have the Congress go along with him. And that's the part that upsets me more than anything, I think. And there are some other reasons as well. I mean, New Zealand and the way which it reacted with regard to guns and the shooting that occurred there versus the United States. The United States surely can do better.
Well, as we wrap up here, are there mysteries of Earth's operation that you still hope to tackle from New Zealand?
We've got what I think is some quite nice work that's submitted for publication at the moment. We've been able to balance the energy budget much more accurately than we've ever been able to do that before, and now I'm not just referring to the global picture, which is we've had a handle on for some time, but locally. And so we can actually track much better what's going on in the oceans locally and how it relates to what's going on in the atmosphere. And I mentioned to you before these hot spots that are associated with hurricanes and so on. And so as the climate varies and changes, one of the goals is to be able to track these things in close to real time and to use that information for better forecasts of the entire hurricane season, There are forecasts made of that, but they're not very specific. And, you know, maybe they can get better. And there have been a number of marine heat waves in various parts of the world oceans. There was one just a few years ago, 2015-16 or thereabouts in the North Pacific, which they estimate led to the loss of over 100 million cod. And it had profound effects that have been measured throughout the entire food web, all the way from the phytoplankton to the zooplankton, the small fish, larger fish, all of the things that prey on the fish, including the whales. There was a big loss of whales that was documented. And then there are, you know, things like sea otters and marine animals along the coast that are affected by these kind of things. And, you know, just recently there has been a marine heat wave in the South Tasman Sea, which is, you know, right near New Zealand. And there was one there about, 2016 as well, perhaps in association with the big El Nino event. And so there have been all kinds of strange creatures and fish and so on showing up in places like Tasmania, you know, in the southern part of Australia. And so these kind of things are happening around the world and are having big and sometimes quite alarming impacts.
I think marine heat waves is a topic that I'm going to have to cover in a show because it obviously doesn't cover by TV news in the United States or Europe because we live on land, but it's a very important thing, and I thank you for that insight. We've been speaking with Dr. Kevin Trenberth, a distinguished senior scientist specializing in climate analysis at the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Colorado. You can find links to find out more in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Kevin, thank you so much for sharing your valuable time with us.
You're most welcome.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. As Hurricane Dorian just ripped through Florida, we need to emphasize what Dr. Trenberth just told us. The oceans have absorbed most of the abnormal heat energy from humans loading the atmosphere with greenhouse gases. Some say up to 90% of the real warming went into the oceans, and water holds heat better than land. The atmosphere hardly holds any heat at all. All the record hot years in the seas were in the last 4 years, with 2018 the hottest ever recorded. Trenberth just explained this extra heat is not evenly distributed. Hot spots and marine heat waves can pop up anywhere in the world. The warmest patches in the ocean move around. In 2017, one of the warmest patches was in the Gulf of Mexico, and that led to Harvey. In 2018, one of the warmest patches of ocean was off the coast of the Carolinas, which added to the destructive power of Hurricane Florence. Hot patches occurred in the Indian Ocean, leading to very unusual cyclones or hurricanes that devastated Mozambique and neighboring countries in March 2019. Those were Cyclone Idai and Kenneth. Trenberth credits ocean hot patches also for Cyclone Fani that struck India and Pakistan in May 2019. Now, most of us have heard TV weather experts explain that a hotter ocean can add energy to hurricanes, as both added rains to drop and flood things, and as higher wind speeds. But they never connect that to the big picture of warming oceans all over the world. Our hotter ocean pops up as strong and unusual storms half a world away from countries emitting the most greenhouse gases. The hurricanes or cyclones strike innocent countries like Mozambique or Bangladesh. This is one of the ways our pollution spreads damage to other countries with tiny emissions. At the international level, there's been a lot of talk about rising seas overcoming island nations, and there should be, but very little about devastating storm damage. Random ocean hotspots sound to me like a weapon in a kind of climate war against the world, a kind of carbon terrorism. The carbon killers are populated with very nice people. Along with my own country of Canada, one of the leading carbon terrorists is surprising. I asked who the biggest supplier of natural gas to the world is and of coal. And for gas, you might think of a Middle Eastern country like Qatar, which used to be the leader, or Russia, the gas giant that heats Europe. No, The biggest exporter of natural gas is Australia. That pleasant land down under is also the biggest coal exporter in the world. Australia exports the carbon that lashes out in mega storms, mega fires, and ungodly floods all over the world. The current government of Australia is not sorry about it at all. They use fake Kyoto carbon credits to pretend they're going along with climate action. The ruling party is a home for climate deniers and anti-science. In fact, the Australian government wants to make even more planet-killing jobs with even more mega coal mines. They sell mostly to Asia, with India company Adani investing billions there. There isn't a lot of Australian exports that climate-aware consumers in Europe or America can boycott. Australia has become the dirty petrostate selling to Asia. Only when those customer countries convert to renewables or stop buying Australia LNG and coal, we can expect some action from a country whose main industry is killing off the future for generations to come. In Australia, groups like GetUp and Greenpeace are fighting fossil fuel expansion tooth and nail, but so far the public is content to let the darkness grow. Australia, we love you, but let's talk. You are quickly becoming the loved relative who succumbs to addiction, to fossil fuel addiction. Please seek help. We need you back as a peaceful member of the world community. There are climate milestones, the markers in what could be called a journey toward hell. Surely the July heat wave in Europe was one of those. Heat records in France were not just broken, they were smashed by many degrees. Paris has never been so hot in recorded history than in July 25, 2019, when it almost reached 110 degrees Fahrenheit or 43 degrees C. That is just nuts. It was all scorching hot across northern Europe, where air conditioning is scarce. It was only the second time in history that a temperature over 100 degrees F or 37.7 C was recorded in London, England. Scientists estimate summers in the last 17 years in Europe are hotter than any in the previous 500 years. And before that, we don't have records to know. But the recent record, this July, may be higher than in the last thousands or even millions of years in Europe. While the heat caused discomfort and suffering, it may have not caused a lot of heat deaths this time, compared to tens of thousands of people dying in the European heat wave of 2003. So if you measure the oncoming heat by mortality, you will be totally fooled. We may be able to adapt better and better as things get hotter and hotter, until, of course, we can't adapt any longer. However, such heat events may help governments at least admit we're in a climate emergency and power movements like Extinction Rebellion.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Let's get on to our next guest, Dr. Edward Hanna, who explains more about the shocking melt on Greenland this year.
Oh my God! Breaking up!
When billions of metric tons of Greenland ice melted into the sea in 2012, a team of scientists said it was more than global warming, a pattern of atmospheric pressure zones called the North Atlantic Oscillation, or NAO, was boosting the big melt. Now that supermelt on Greenland has happened again, this summer of 2019, hundreds of billions of metric tons of ice just poured off Greenland into the sea. Sea levels will rise measurably from what happened there just in July. Edward Hanna, Javier Fetvis, and team published the paper Important Role of Mid-Tropospheric Atmospheric Circulation in the Recent Surface Melt Increase over the Greenland Ice Sheet, and that was about 2012. Dr. Edward Hanna is a professor of climate science and meteorology at the University of Lincoln, UK. We last spoke on Radio EcoShock in January 2018 about a cold pattern in North American or European winters due to changes in the Arctic. Edward Hanna, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much, Alex.
The size and the speed of that Greenland melt this summer just shocked me. I thought, this is a major climate event, and it's one the public cannot see. Did it surprise you?
Well, not at all, really, because, I mean, after the mammoth surface melts of 2012, which was arguably even greater from some measures, it seemed quite clear to me and other scientists, I think, as well, who are working on Greenland, that you don't need that much of an extra warming to actually recreate that event. So the ice sheet's already quite warm around the edges in summer. So just making it 1 or 2 degrees warmer and shifting warm air masses slightly further north over Greenland is going to have a big response with the melt.
So coexisting with the hottest July ever recorded by humans, we have this other strange invisible force. What is the North Atlantic Oscillation, please?
So the North Atlantic Oscillation, it's basically measuring the airflow across the North Atlantic Ocean. Now, because the Earth is rotating, there's a prevailing jet stream that generally flows from west to east, which is also driven by a difference in heat, where generally it's hotter further south than further north. So there's always an attempt by the atmosphere to redistribute heat from further south towards further north. So the jet stream is always doing that to some level, and the North Atlantic Oscillation is a way of measuring the jet stream activity in the North Atlantic region. Now, imagine if you had two household barometers that measure air pressure, and one of them's in the Azores Islands in the middle of the Atlantic, in the subtropics, so somewhere in the 30s latitude, and the other barometer is located on Iceland, much further north in the North Atlantic. So if you take a simple pressure gradient, so the difference that the air pressure between those two barometers across the North Atlantic, then in effect that's giving you a measure of the strength of the winds across the North Atlantic, because the air pressure difference is related to how strong the winds are. And that's basically what the North Atlantic Oscillation is. It's a difference in air pressure at the surface from a barometer further south in the North Atlantic, difference from a barometer further north in the North Atlantic.
How do we know there are two phases and what phase we are in?
So now what can happen is the jet stream, although it normally flows from west to east across the North Atlantic, it can sometimes reverse direction and actually flow in the opposite way, or sometimes neutralize. There's no net airflow going from west to east or the opposite across the North Atlantic. So the two phases of the North Atlantic Oscillation are simply measuring the direction of airflow and the strength of the winds and air pressure gradients across the North Atlantic. So under normal conditions, you have a positive NAO phase. So that's with westerly winds blowing from west to east across the North Atlantic. When a jet stream weakens and sometimes reverses direction, you can get a negative NAO phase, which is with easterly winds across the North Atlantic. So it's a matter of definition, but also there's a real physical change linked in with that.
Well, what you've said just explains something I've been wondering about, because various news organizations and a couple of scientists said that the great heat wave that went over France and Northern Europe this past summer, I think it was in July, slid over to Greenland. And I thought, well, how can the air be moving west against the jet stream? But sometimes it does reverse like that, and it could slide from Europe up over into Greenland.
Yes, and in fact, this was a rather unusual direction of air mass that affected the summer conditions over Greenland, because normally when you get a heat wave over Greenland in summer, it's air masses that are coming from the southwest or from the south, more with a westerly direction up over the western flank of the ice sheet. But in this case, the weather charts show quite definitely that the air pressure situation developed southeast of Greenland and actually moved west from the east side of Greenland up over the ice sheet.
Now, trying to learn what the NAO is, the public is given the analogy of the El Niño-La Niña cycles in the Pacific Ocean, which we've come to learn because it affects our own weather, especially here in North America. Is that good enough, or can we do better?
I think we can probably do better. I think from one point of view, it's useful to make that comparison, but they are two quite different weather systems. So whereas the El Niño is very tightly coupled between the ocean and the atmosphere conditions over the tropical Pacific Ocean, albeit it affects weather conditions further afield sometimes, the North Atlantic Oscillation can actually operate without any significant effect from the ocean. And computer models that have actually been simulating this have demonstrated this in some previous studies. However, that's not to say that there's not an effect of the ocean on the NAO or that the NAO can't affect the ocean. It's just that it's a less strong effect probably than with the El Nino. So the other point to note is that the North Atlantic Oscillation, it's involving middle latitude climates, which are inherently quite different from tropical climates, which is where the El Nino originates.
Has the NAO continued in its current phase since that big Greenland melt of 2012? I mean, how long does one cycle last?
Well, there's actually no preferred time scale of activity. There are weak peaks of activity, if you like, at something like 6 or 10 or 17 years, something on those time scales. And in fact, I'm just looking now at a graph of the NAO that I drew up for the last just over a century or so. And it does look that every few decades you get peaks and troughs. But again, it's a little bit chaotic and there's a lot of noise amongst the signal there. But what we saw in 2012 was an unusually deep negative phase of the NAO, so unusually low NAO or negative NAO, that was repeated to some level this summer. So the NAO has been quite negative for most of this summer. And when that happens, you get high pressure developing over Greenland, as we saw very strong in 2012, but also this year. However, some of the intervening years between 2012 and this year, 2019, have actually had quite positive NAOs or relatively weak high-pressure blockings over Greenland. So there is a lot of year-to-year variability in the NAO and high pressure over Greenland, as well as the longer decadal timescale variability. So it's a complex picture. But basically, there have been some quite large year-to-year fluctuations in the NAO between 2012 and the present year.
So is there any way to assess how much of the recent huge ice loss on Greenland is due to the NAO state and how much to global warming or other things like the albedo change?
Yeah, so there have been a number of studies that have attempted to isolate the various what we call driving or forcing effects of melting or mass change on the ice sheet. So these include things like the general global warming trend, as well as year-to-year variability of the North Atlantic Oscillation or of high pressure blocking over Greenland. So there is a significant effect from natural variability. It might be very roughly half of the signal in any given year from natural variability, but there's also a very strong effect from the global warming signal as well in driving the recent general warming in Greenland and quite dramatic increase in loss of mass of the ice sheet that we've seen in the last 15 to 20 years or so.
So what happens when we go to the other pattern of pressure?
So this year it's been a quite a strong negative NAO, as was the situation in 2012, which, as I say, means high pressure blocking over Greenland, which tends to drag up warmer southerly airflow and melt the ice sheet. So the opposite NAO conditions would be a positive NAO phase, which would tend to be linked with weaker blocking over Greenland and less melt, all other things being equal. The point here, of course, is that things are not equal because of global warming. So superimposed on all this natural variability, we also have a general warming trend, which means that various accelerated melt kicks in over the ice sheet. So darkening of the ice sheet surface, for example, due to various feedbacks as you get more melt, it accelerates the melting with a darker water at the surface and more impurities at the surface. So there's other feedbacks as well, such as the effects of a warmer ocean around Greenland, which mean that even with these natural weather changes, if you like, from year to year, even if the natural cycle swings back the other way, because we've got a strong warming effect on Greenland from global warming, it's not enough to counter the increase in the melt that we've seen. It might slow it down a bit for a few years, but not really stop it.
I'm interested in how climate change can sometimes alter these big systems, and I wonder, could the NAO pressure system over the Atlantic get stuck in one position or dwindle to no effect due to climate change? What are your thoughts?
Well, I think due to climate change, we're seeing higher pressure over Greenland in summer, which is obviously that's the season when it's warmest, when you get the main melting of the ice sheet and the mass being lost from the ice sheet each year. There's good physical reasons to expect that high pressure will prevail in summer and become even stronger moving ahead. So one factor is that warmer air masses over the ice sheet expands. That gives you higher pressure on average. So this tends to block and divert the jet stream, push it further south more in summer over the North Atlantic and give you a more negative or a reduced NEO signal. But there's many effects on NEO and other effects from changes in sea temperature patterns in the North Atlantic, for example. But there's actually many effects on the jet stream and the NEO. So I don't think there's any reliable simulations at the regional level of how the climate will change over the North Atlantic. So it's not like the global climate model predictions where we know fairly reliably that there's going to be a strong and significant warming, albeit we can't precisely define the amount. But looking at the jet stream over the North Atlantic is such a complex picture that we can't really definitely say how it's going to play out during the rest of this century. But there are lots of effects, and so we're likely to see further changes.
Dr. James Hansen and a long list of co-authors published a mammoth paper, and in that discussion, the scientists suggest the North Atlantic could cool from Greenland meltwaters even as the rest of the world is warming. Do you see that happening, and what might that mean for weather in the Northern Hemisphere?
So the oceanography aspect of increased melt from Greenland is really quite interesting because we do see increased meltwater running off of parts of the southern margins of the ice sheet in particular, and particularly on the eastern side, or southeastern side of the ice sheet. That can potentially be concentrated, focused in quite a small region and affect the stability of ocean waters in that part of the North Atlantic. In particular, potentially it could affect the so-called deep water part of the global ocean circulation. I think the studies I've seen so far, there's a lot of conflicting opinions, and we simply don't know enough because we don't have enough span of observations. But there is a cooling, or certainly not a temperature increase, in part of the North Atlantic, just southeast of Greenland, in the last 10 or 20 years or so. And I certainly think that an increase in ice melt could be contributing to that regional cooling. However, at the global level, that's a relatively unimportant change, although if it bears out during the rest of this century, it could have some severe consequences on the making the winter climates of parts of northwest Europe, the UK, for example, more severe. We don't really have enough evidence here yet, I would say.
Right, and several popular press articles bring up the change of reflectivity of the sun's rays, or albedo, in the Greenland ice problem, and certainly falling smoke from record fires in the Arctic are darkening the glaciers, but is there also a change in albedo simply because the surface layer has melted away?
Well, there's certainly increased melting, and meltwater itself is darker, and the increased melting exposes more impurities near the surface of the ice. So not just smoke from forest fires, but other impurities and rocky debris and even biogenic debris within the ice, algae and so on. So overall, most of the data from satellites for the last couple of decades seem to suggest a decline in the albedo of the ice. So it's getting darker, the ice surface, and this tends to accelerate the melting and warming of much of the ice sheet. But it's not simply because of melting of the surface ice, but it's all these other factors and feedback effects, some of which I've mentioned.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. We are talking about the huge loss of ice on Greenland with Dr. Edward Hanna, Professor of Climate Science and Meteorology at the University of Lincoln in the UK. Edward, does most of the meltwater go into the ocean, or does some of it evaporate, raising humidity in the atmosphere?
Well, there will be a secondary effect for increased evaporation of near-surface water, but we've got to remember the Arctic atmosphere is pretty cold compared with further south. It can hold a limited amount of water vapor. I think the main effect by far is for increased meltwater to go into the ocean.
And how much has sea level gone up because of Greenland melt?
Well, in the last, I would say, 17, 18 years, there have been a series of satellites called GRACE, which have been quite accurately measuring long-term changes in the mass balance of the ice sheet. So it's something like 250 billion tons per year averaged over that period. So that's equivalent this century so far to something like 10 to 15 millimeters of sea level rise because of melting from the ice sheet. Of course, that's only part of the global sea level rise. There's lots of other factors that are increasing global sea level as well.
And do you have an informed guess about how much ice Greenland might lose by the end of the century, and what sea level rise might come from that?
It's quite poorly known still at the moment. I think a conservative, so lower end estimate would be probably somewhere between 10 and 15 centimetres of extra sea level rise from Greenland by the rest of this century. However, in my opinion, and I think that there's a number of other scientists who agree, it could be considerably larger than that, so easily double that. And remember that actually, at the moment, Greenland is the main contributor from the icy realm to sea level rise, but there's also probably nearly equal from Antarctic ice sheets, and actually a greater contribution from warmer seawater expanding as it gets warmer, so thermal expansion of warmer seawater. So that's only still a relatively small part of the overall sea level story. So overall, it could easily be somewhere around a metre, potentially even a bit more by the end of this century. Sorry, that's in terms of the overall sea level rise, not from purely from Greenland.
Yes, understood. So when we talk about Antarctica, a lot of the scientific looks are at warmer seawaters going under the glaciers and licking away at the base of them. Do you think that's happening in Greenland as well, warmer oceans moving into the Arctic?
Yes. So there are a number of what we call outlets or sea-terminating glaciers from Greenland. It's not as many as for Antarctica, but they are major outlets of the Greenland ice sheet, nevertheless. So, for example, Jakobshavn in the west of the ice sheet and Kangerlussuaq and Helheim in the east. And there are others as well. So there's certainly very likely to already have been an effect of warmer ocean water is in destabilizing those glacier termini in the last couple of decades or so. But what we're seeing from the warmer oceans propagating into the Arctic or warming of Arctic seawater is melting of the sea ice even more immediately. And of course, that in turn can also feed back on melting extra ice over the Greenland region that is land-based.
How can loss of sea ice affect the melting of Greenland?
Well, because you're exposing Greenland, which is used to be surrounded by sea ice for a longer part of the year, at least in the northern regions, to potentially warmer air masses if the ocean is closer to the margins of the land or the ice sheets.
Right. There was a big open patch north of Greenland last year. That was unusual, and it's happened again this year.
Yes, so I've not looked directly at that, but just flying over back from a meeting in Alaska a few weeks ago, even much further north in the Beaufort Sea near to the North Pole, it was quite striking how much open water areas within the ice. But, of course, from satellite data, we have a fairly complete picture of sea ice changes going back for a few decades now, and we've lost something like three-quarters of the volume of the sea ice cover in the Arctic Ocean in late summer in the month of September since the late 1970s.
I worry, Edward, that some global warming denier, and there are a few left, they'll try and use a bit of your research against climate claims. They might say, well, you see, Greenland melting's just a natural cycle. It's the NAO. It will switch back to cold. It's not climate change. What do you say to that?
Well, climate is always changing. So from one point of view, they're right, but superimposed on the natural variability, such as the NAO, although I would argue that part of the NAO is not necessarily naturally driven, is this very strong warming trend through greenhouse gas increases from human activity. And that is really the dominant climate trend if we look at the last 50 years at the global scale. And it's certainly having an effect on Greenland temperatures in the last 20 years or so. So I've been involved in some work where we've looked at how the climate regionally in Greenland corresponds to wider global temperatures as well as to these natural cycles such as the NAO. And we see a much more direct association of the Greenland temperatures with the global temperatures in the later parts of the record. So I would certainly suggest that there's very strong evidence from the Arctic and Greenland from climate science that bears out the idea of a accelerated effect of human-driven climate change on the Arctic region, including Greenland.
You co-authored a paper saying that climate models completely failed to predict the sudden speed of ice loss on Greenland. So we don't really know what could happen there?
So I think the paper you're referring to, possibly, correct me if I'm wrong, please, was the had a paper out last year with Xavier Fetwy and Richard Hall in the Cryosphere, which I think you interviewed me, incidentally, last November on. And that was highlighting some of the latest generation of global climate models, their failure to predict accurately regional changes in air circulation over the Greenland region, so changes in high pressure that we've been talking about earlier in this current interview. So there is a mismatch between some of the best available recent climate models and what the observations have shown for the last decade. So watch this space, because we need to improve the climate models at the regional level.
And way back in 2006 when I began this program, Edward scientists calmed us saying Greenland would take thousands of years to melt. It would be gradual and it would be orderly. What is the thinking now among specialists who research as you do?
So it's certainly true that because it's such a vast mass of ice, that it would take at least a couple of thousand years to melt in its entirety. However, the quite big effects could be seen much earlier on within that overall melt cycle, of course. So that's already starting in the sense that Greenland is very far from being in balance. We've already got something like a 250 to 300 billion tons per year of net ice mass loss into the oceans. That's directly affecting global sea level rise. And of course, as it warms further, then that is likely to accelerate in a way that is not, it's actually non-linear. So the more warming, the more it accelerates the ice melt. So as I said before in this interview, getting somewhere in the order of 15, 20, up to 30 centimetres of sea level rise contributed from the Greenland ice sheet within or by the end of this century is quite plausible, I think.
When the Arctic sea ice collapsed in 2007, I thought it was time to panic about climate change. And now after the Arctic 2019 setting all sorts of ugly records, I feel that deep uneasiness again. Can we still keep calm and carry on, so to speak?
Well, I think actually it's not perhaps so much an early warning sign because there have been lots of warning signs, but it's certainly bearing out the some of the worst predictions in a sense from the climate models, or in fact some of the Arctic changes were not predicted by the climate models. It's a case where the observations are actually progressing more rapidly than the models were predicting, say, 20 years ago. So I share your deep uneasiness. It is also a sense of great fascination to be able to watch what's actually happening. But it would be nice perhaps to be able to do something a bit more about it. And perhaps some of this latest evidence from the Arctic will encourage us all to take stock of these changes and see what we can do about them.
From the University of Lincoln, we've been talking with Professor Edward Hanna. Find links to the science we've discussed and more news about the Greenland melt in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Edward, thank you for sharing your time again with us.
Thank you very much, Alex.
From Australia, my friend and longtime anti-nuclear/climate activist, Christina McPherson, writes, "In Australia, this rich and privileged country, we nevertheless have a high rate of youth mental illness and youth suicide. While I do believe that the innermost connections, parents, family, and friends, are of paramount importance, they are not the whole story. For the first time, this concept is taken up in this article. Feeling anxious about climate change? Therapists say you're not alone." Writing in People magazine, columnist Victoria Knight says, "The psychiatric and psychological communities have names for the phenomenon of worrying about Earth's fate: climate distress, climate grief, climate anxiety, or eco-anxiety." Time magazine reports that suicide rates in America are the highest since World War II this year. Is climate anxiety and fear of the future part of that? It has to be. I hope my Radio EcoShock show does not contribute to this. I think people are better off to know the facts than to fear them in the background. Of course, there's much more going on than climate, with ongoing nuclear fear, alienation aided by cyber reality, mass extinction of our fellow species, overpopulation, and a sense the whole thing could implode at any time, like New York going dark and staying that way. Personally, I continue to cherish life and the privilege of living each day, even if the future is in danger. Our garden has never been better. Our harvest is rich. Our weather has been good and almost smoke-free this year. When it comes to climate change, do we just need new leaders? Can we have some sort of democratic revolution that will fix it all? I'm just not so sure. Here's George Carlin, the late comedian.
But there's a reason. There's a reason. There's a reason for this. There's a reason education sucks, and it's the same reason that it will never, ever, ever be fixed. Because the owners of this country don't want that. I'm talking about the real owners now. The real owners, the big wealthy business interests that control things and make all the important decisions. Forget the politicians. They're irrelevant. The politicians are put there to give you the idea that you have freedom of choice. You don't. You have owners. They own you. They own everything. They own all the important land. They own and control the corporations. They've long since bought and paid for the Senate, the Congress, the state houses, the city halls. They got the judges in their back pockets. And they own all the big media companies, so they control just about all of the news and information you get to hear. They got you by the balls. They spend billions of dollars every year lobbying to get what they want. Well, we know what they want. They want more for themselves and less for everybody else. But I'll tell you what they don't want. They don't want a population of citizens capable of critical thinking. They don't want well-informed, well-educated people capable of critical thinking. They're not interested in that. That doesn't help them. That's against their interest. That's right. You know something? They don't want people who are smart enough to sit around the kitchen table to figure out how badly they're getting f***ed by a system that threw them overboard 30 years ago. They don't want that. You know what they want? They want obedient workers. Obedient workers. People who are just smart enough to run the machines and do the paperwork and just dumb enough to passively accept all these increasingly shittier jobs with the lower pay, the longer hours, the reduced benefits, the end of overtime, and the vanishing pension that disappears the minute you go to collect it. And now they're coming for your Social Security money. They want your retirement money. They want it back so they can give it to their criminal friends on Wall Street. And you know something? They'll get it. They'll get it all from you sooner or later because they own this place. It's a big club, and you ain't in it. You and I are not in the big club.
That was the late George Carlin. I wish I could be confident that the climate dishonesty comes from the top. While I'm not a fan of Karl Marx, he did say capitalists themselves are as deluded as the workers. Even though the rape of the world is led by a small group of, well, mostly men who play the game of piling up money and power until death levels them, even so, we all agree, as long as it appears to benefit us in these short-term lives that biology gives us. We're comfortable. We're living in times of undreamt-of opportunities. Would you like to appear on the other side of the world? No problem if you have the money, if you are one of the insiders. You and I are insiders. I could fly to Australia. My air miles benefit would be to hurry up the extinction of more species, possibly including our own. Reading history shows us humans have dangerous flaws. We are predators who too often prey on each other, and I'm not sure it will be enough to just replace our leaders, although I would love to see what happens, to see some progress, real progress. Climate denial may be manufactured for the power and profit for a few, but it is broadcast by the stupidity and willingness of the many. To not acknowledge what is happening to our environment, even as it repeatedly punches us in the face, in Greenland, in the Amazon, all over, in our homes, it seems like a suicidal flaw, doesn't it? There's no doctor to help. We can only heal ourselves when we admit the sickness, and I think that is part of what Radio EcoShock is about. Next week, we send the EcoShock Climate Ambulance after another great tragedy unfolding, the fires. There are two tropical climate war zones to report, the famous case of fires in the Amazon, but also more in the Angola and the Congo. The week following, I hope to have the latest on the Arctic fires, which may threaten us even more, and I'll tell you why. We need to talk about humans planning their retreat from the coasts, the sudden heat as we clean up air pollution, and so much more. I'm Alex Smith. We have a lot of work to do to find peace and balance in our planetary home. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.